Are you ready for new dimensions and countless possibilities today and for the future? It's an exciting new time, and the answers are out there. So join Mary Jane Popp as she explores the unique and unusual for a better life on Pop Talk in search of the truth. And here she is, Mary Jane Popp.
Yep, thanks so much, Mike. I am here, and I've got two dynamic ladies on in this hour. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking with Lady Diana Ziegler. Lady Diana was the first African-American woman to be knighted. So we got a whole story around that. But before we do that, we want to talk about really people and what they go through in life, how they achieve different levels, how they have dreams, and how they come out of some terrible situations. And it's a matter of hope, that there is hope for everyone in every situation. And we're going to tell you about one of them. Well, she has mastered the ability to transform pain into powerful storytelling. From childhood drama, she emerged a successful author and playwright, and also an actress. Aretha Thomas has made her life special and wants others to know that they can overcome through her works. Now, Aretha is an actress, award-winning playwright, award-winning novelist, with her latest endeavor called The Daughter Between Them. So nice to have you with us, Aretha.
It's nice to be here, Mary Jane. Thank you. Thank you for that beautiful introduction.
Well, you know, I only tell it like it is. I am very honest about it. Now, your whole beginnings and the influence on what's happened in your life goes back to when you were a three-year-old and the terrible things that you had to go through.
Well, when I was three, that memory is very vivid. Because what happened, we were living in Oakland at the time. I was born in Oakland. And I remember being in our bedroom. I shared a bedroom with my two older siblings. And I was sitting there, and I was fascinated with books.
Good for you.
I've come full circle.
Yeah.
But I was flipping through the pages of a picture book, and I remember turning to the left. The window was open. And I could see our neighbor, this woman, walking toward the window, and she had a big metal pail, and I could see steam coming out of it.
Oh,
but
God.
At three, I couldn't, you know, figure out what was really going on. I had no idea. The next thing I knew, water was coming through the window. She had boiled scalding water.
Oh, dear.
And we believed that she meant that for my mom. We really believed that she was going to knock on the door, and my mother was going to open it, and she was going to pour to my mother. She was jealous of my mother.
Oh.
But what better way to hurt her than to hurt her child? And so she put the water through the window. It landed on my legs.
Oh.
I ended up having second-degree burns. I had to learn to walk again. My sister, who's 6 years older than me, said that she would hear me screaming. Like, I would be screaming when they would change the bandages,
oh.
And I had to get skin grafts. It was a horrible ordeal. I just thank God that I can't remember the pain.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember my mother bursting through the room when she heard my cries. And I remember vividly the panic in her face and her ripping the pants. And I remember still the pants. They were orange corduroy pants.
Aww.
And I could see the pink flesh. And my sister said the whole neighborhood was surrounded, the ambulance, police. The woman, I believe, was institutionalized. She was mentally ill. She used to go down and raise her skirt and throw candy at the kids.
Oh.
But no one had any idea she would do something that horrific.
Oh, God. Yes.
But I survived that, and only to, you know, have other things happen.
You were molested by your own family or a family associate, right?
It was a family associate.
Oh, okay.
My mom married my baby sister's father. That was my stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in and out of jail. So this is one of the times he was in jail. So she had associates. And this particular man would come by And I had to be maybe 4 or 5, something like that. Aww. I wasn't that old because I remember the stove was taller than I was.
Mm-hmm.
So there were times where he would catch me alone and he would touch me. And then I remember being asleep and him trying to put his member in my mouth. And
oh, dear
I just,
God.
Just turned away. And in my 3-year-old, in my 4 or 5-year-old mind, I intuitively knew, Jane, that Mary Jane, that something, this wasn't right.
Yeah,
that he wasn't
yeah.
supposed to be doing this. And it was weird. It was odd. I was fearful. I would dread when I knew he was coming. I would panic internally.
Oh.
But I didn't have the voice to tell my mother. I just.
Good for
I
you.
I didn't have the voice.
Oh, you didn't?
I couldn't tell her at 4 or 5 years old.
Oh.
I felt uncomfortable. I didn't know how to tell her.
Oh.
But what I didn't know at that point is that she had found out because I wasn't the only one that he was bothering in the home. And I heard my mother almost tried to kill him when she found out. And she got rid of him. But what was ironic, a few years later, when my stepfather was out of jail, my mother one time, and I had onesies on, I was real young, and I remember she asked me, she said, "Is he touching you down there?" And she kind of pointed in that area,
mm-hmm.
and I just shook my head, no. But she was referring to my stepfather, who beat me mercilessly, but he wasn't a molester.
He beat you?
But in my head, I thought, but the other guy did. But again, I couldn't tell.
Oh.
In my mind, I was like, he didn't, but the other guy did.
Oh,
I couldn't formulate those words.
Wow.
But
you were just a baby. How can you do
yeah,
that?
Yeah, as you can imagine, I was a very nervous child. I was walked on eggshells all the time. I was very fearful. And when my stepfather, how he came into the picture, he was like a drill sergeant. And I count illness to all these people. And he would, everything had to be perfect. When we would come home from school, before we came into the house, we would look at one another and we would say, "How do I look?"
Because
everything had to be in order. And I was elementary school. My shoes, and if I broke something, I would get beaten. And then I was a bedwetter.
Oh,
would you think? You know, and I would have
with
dreams.
All that, yeah.
Yeah, I would have dreams that I was on the toilet. I kid you not, Mary Jane, I knew I was on the toilet. And the next thing I know, I'm in the morning, I would be wet. Or sometimes I would wake up wet, and I'd be like, "How did this happen?" And then I would get extension cord beads.
Oh,
and it would be terror. And so there were times where I would think, okay, maybe if I stay up all night, if I could stay up all night, then I would know when I have to use the restroom and I could go to the restroom.
Mm-hmm.
Or I thought about sleeping on the floor. So if something happened, there wouldn't be soiled sheets. And then I would try to hide the sheets and I would get beaten. So it was like a no-win situation.
Oh, that's amazing. And then at 14 to find your mother dead in your house. I mean, that's what trauma is that?
Yeah. So getting through all of that, and I just need to set the record straight. My mother was asthmatic. She was away from her family. My mother was stop traffic beautiful. She was gorgeous. And so that was a curse and a blessing because she attracted the wrong people,
mm-hmm.
and they would take advantage of her when she was sickly. And so my stepfather was around then. He had stopped beating me. I had stopped waiting to bed. But I was taking care of my mom. My 3 older siblings were out of the house, so I was trying to make sure she was okay. She was having asthma badly.
Mm.
My stepfather was dabbling in drugs and doing other kind of things and exposing my mother to things. And so I remember that day. It was 1975, September, and I remember going outside, and when I came back, my mom was on the couch, and she was laid out on the couch. And so I don't know how I knew. I just, something wasn't right, and I said, "Mommy," and I touched her, and she was already cool to the touch.
Oh, dear.
And I was just like, okay. And so she didn't move, and I ran to the back. And before I went out, I had seen her in the bathroom, and something was going on with her in the bathroom, but I had seen her in so many kind of precarious situations. I just thought it was the same old thing. But
mm-hmm.
So when I went to the back, I wrote a note to my sister and told her, my baby sister, and I told her, "Mommy's dead." And I said, take this to your dad. So she went down there, and the next thing I know, I could hear these heavy feet pounding. He was a heavy guy. He was a big guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like I blanked out or I had a blackout, because the next thing I know, time had passed, and he was coming back saying my mother was no longer with us.
Oh.
And I just remember having this feeling of disconnection, like when you see the astronauts in space and they're floating with no gravity. I felt like I was just floating in space with no attachment, and I was lost in space. And it was the most surreal feeling of not having your mother. It was unfathomable. I couldn't fathom it. You know, because we look at our parents, they're immortal to us.
Oh,
they're,
yeah.
They're not going to die. And so even though my mom was sickly and all the things that we had been through, I still never could imagine her not being there. And it was, and any time anyone asked me, I just lost it. I just cried and cried. And it was difficult. It was obviously one of the most difficult years of my life.
Oh, absolutely.
And so we moved,
you know what you were doing? You were just a kid, for God's sake. You closed down. You know,
yeah.
You shut it down. That's why you felt like you're just floating someplace. And that's survival. That's a survival possibility. You know, you're trying to just be a person who's going to go on. And that it's knowing all these things that happened to you, how did you claw your way out of this? I mean, that's amazing.
Well, my mother used to always say I was strong. She said, you're so strong. But she met, when my stepfather was in jail, she met a preacher. He was a bus driver. And he introduced her to Christianity. My mom and my stepfather were Muslim. But he introduced my mom to Christianity, and they lived not far from us. And they embraced us and kind of adopted me and my other siblings, and we went to their church. I accepted Christ when I was 11. I got baptized when I was 13. I got heavily in the church, and I was in my Bible. So I had the church behind me, and I was had God behind me in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say that is really what got me through. We moved to Compton. I went to high school. I graduated second in my class. I studied hard, and I was very studious even when my mom was going through all of that, and I used school to escape. And I, before my mom passed, I had got accepted into Lowell Prep, which is a college preparatory high school. But I went on to high school in Compton, graduated second in my class, got scholarships and loans to go to USC.
No,
and then that's when all the trauma hit. That's when I began to act it out.
Oh.
And I
now, is
crazy.
That before or after you worked with the for Tyler Perry on his television
show? This is before. This is like in my 20s.
Oh, okay.
This is like back in the 80s.
Okay.
And so I'm going, you know, being in places I shouldn't, drinking too much. I became bulimic. I became anorexic. All of this stuff, I start acting out my trauma. I just start acting it out. And I remember at SC, I saw a counselor, and they weren't of any help because all the guy said was, well, just stop doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, really? And so I became disillusioned with counseling. But in my early 30s, I dabbled in acting in my early 20s, mid-20s. I got a few acting jobs. I dabbled in modeling, but I had to step away. I had to step away in my early 30s because I was a basket case. I had to get help. I was just a basket case emotionally, spiritually, in every way, and I had to get help. And I ended up getting involved with someone I shouldn't have, and they put hands on me, and I had to go to the hospital. And that was when I hit bottom, and I said, I need help. And I got help, and I got help from a counselor who had 12-step background, and the first thing they told me I needed to do, and this is my early 30s, and they told me, they said, you have to first recognize you got a problem, and I did. My life was crazy. And they said, whoever your spiritual power is, you need to tap into that. And that was God for me, Jesus.
Yeah.
And so I did, and I got back in church, and they told me that I had a lot of forgiving I needed to do, that I needed a lot of cleaning up to do. So I start thinking about all the people that I had resentment for,
mm-hmm.
and the person on the top of the list was God, and then it was my stepfather, my biological father, my mom, myself, and the list went on and on and on.
Oh, wow.
And they told me that I needed, and these are the processes that helped me get out of this and come back better and bigger than ever, and healed, they said that I needed to forgive all these people and places, and that I had to find my part in what went wrong. And so I'm thinking, well, what part did I have in me being scalded? What part did I have in me being a
Melissa?
And be, but they said it doesn't just try to find it, because what it will do, it will take you out of the victim mode and empower you. And so I thought about the molester, and I said, okay, I didn't tell my mother. I didn't scream. I could have screamed. I could have told my mother. And I just put that. I said, okay, so you could have done that. I said, so I forgive me. I forgive myself for not screaming. I forgive myself for not telling mom. I forgive myself for that. And then I looked at the molester, and I said, okay, and I thought about it. And obviously, at the early 30s, I can think better than at 3.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And so I have a clear mind. So I'm thinking about it. I said, okay, for a grown man to get pleasure out of a child, they have to be sick.
That of course.
Is sickness. And I said, and I can imagine this man looking at, not being able to look at himself in the mirror, all the self-loathing that he had. And I kid you not, Mary Jane, I began to cry for this man.
Oh.
I began to cry for him because I thought about, someone's bringing me tears now.
Oh, bless your heart.
Because I thought about, my God.
You know,
what kind of life did he
you
have?
Are,
and yes,
you know, your mother, your mother was right. You are a strong person.
Yeah.
To do what you did and go through what you did. Now, I know you have to do another interview in about 3.5 minutes, so I don't want to mess up here. Do you have a website?
I do. It's AlrethaThomas.com.
Okay. And the book itself, The Daughter Between
the
Them?
The Daughter Between Them.
Is available where?
Amazon. The Daughter Between Them.
Okay.
But and, I have recovered. Going through that forgiveness process, that... and getting back in church and getting back what God has got me to where I am today.
Well, you're wonderful. And just very briefly, we have about 2 minutes left here. You work with Tyler Perry. What did you do?
I am an actress, a series regular on his show, Assisted Living, that comes on BET.
Oh, cool.
And it will be back, the remainder of season 5 will be back on March 26th on BET. And you could go to BET.com or Prime Video and see Farmer at shows. But we're in our 5th season, and I play Anastasia Devereaux, and I have a ball playing it.
Oh.
And I have a wonderful cast, and Tyler Perry is an amazing man.
I'm sorry to say I have not watched it, but I'm sure going to watch it now.
Assistant Living on BET, and I play Anastasia Devereaux.
Oh, fantastic. Now, The Daughter Between, got 1 minute left here. What do you want, what should people take away from The Daughter Between?
They should take away that mental health is real, because Barbara Morris, one of the characters, has mental illness. She's functional, but if someone had recognized her and gotten her help, a lot of the problems that happened in the book would not have happened. So I want people to take away from, if you see someone struggling, if you're struggling, don't be afraid to reach out and get mental health assistance.
And, you know, I think that is beginning to change, Aretha, because there was a time when, oh, my God, they would put somebody in the closet and not want to talk to them if they had any problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of what happened during the Olympics and everything else, a lot of that is coming out and saying, no, you need to, you know, there's a problem. You got to find help. And I think
But it's an amazing book. I know I'm tooting my horn. It's an amazing book. Kirkus Reviews named it as one of the top 100 indie suspense books of 2024.
Wow.
It's a book you want to get, The Daughter Between Them.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for taking and to sharing from your heart. I really appreciate
it. Thank
you. You're the best. Keep up the good work. People need
that.
Thank
you. God bless you and your listeners.
Thank you. Take care now. That's Aretha Thomas. And again, The Daughter Between Them. And you can go to AlrethaThomas.com or go to BET. Because, you know, the Tyler Perry show, I'm going to have to check that out, because I bet she's a great actress, because she's got so much feeling and emotion in her that is absolutely astounding. Anyway, stay with us. We got the first African-American woman to ever be knighted coming on Pop Talk.
It's amazing. He's a miracle child. In the mornings, he'll wake up and he roll the shades up and, Dada, it's time to get up. It's a bright, beautiful day.
He started getting dizzy. At the first of the year, he started going, I have to sit down, I'm dizzy, Mommy. A month after his 3rd birthday, he got diagnosed with ATRT brain cancer. All you can think of is, the kid's not going to live. the fact that St. Jude doesn't build is a godsend. And the fact that we don't have to ask for help here makes things a lot easier to go through what we have to go through with Beckett. The fact that they are researching and they are saving these children, it's so important. We wouldn't be where we are without St. Jude, and in turn, we wouldn't be where we are without those people that have donated. They're the reason why my son's still alive.
Finding cures, saving children. Learn more at stjude.org.
It's hot to the max in the summer, and your air conditioner gives up the ghost. Who are you going to call? ACP Mechanical, that's who. I did, and I can't believe what a great job they did in my home. It's cool and comfortable with a job well done. Hi, Mary Jane Pop here. Whether it's cooling or heating, Enrique and his ACP Mechanical team can install, repair, commercial or residential, no matter what HVAC system you have or want, and they've done it for over 20 years. Air conditioners, heat pumps, furnaces, thermostats, all quality and affordable solutions, and they're bonded and insured. I know you'll love their work. I do. Call ACP Mechanical, 916-704-8556. That's 916-704-8556 for all your comfort needs. That's ACP Mechanical, 916-704-8556, and expect an expert job well done and right the first time. Well, now, you'll know why I'm playing that particular song. And this lady is incredible. She is the first African-American woman to be knighted. Now, her brother-in-law, William Guest, was a founding member of Gladys Knight and the Pips. Remember Midnight Train to Georgia? Well, she is Lady Diana Ziegler. And her book is called Midnight Train from Georgia. And it captures the love of family, church, entertainment, and surviving in the music industry, which ain't easy, folks. That's a rough road. I call her Lady Di, and I don't think she'll mind. Lady Di is also a songwriter. We're going to find out about that, too. Nice to have you with us, Lady Di.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Terrific. Now, your story, the book itself, Midnight Train from Georgia, is about William Guest, who was your brother-in-law. He's since passed, I believe, 2015, I think?
Yes, he passed in 2015. Yes, he's my brother-in-law, and he was one of the founding members of Gladys Knight and the Pips, because they started as a family with Gladys Knight, her brother Merrill Bubba Knight, her sister Brenda Knight, my brother-in-law, William Guest, and his sister, Eleanor Guest. Oh. Those were the original Pips.
Oh, no kidding. So how long were they together? Was that mainly just local or church groups, or were they, you know?
No, they actually recorded a song together, Whistle My Love. That was from, like, 1952 to 1957. Gladys' sister, Brenda, and my brother-in-law's sister, Eleanor, they decided to leave the group because they wanted to get married.
Oh.
And that's when cousin Edward Patton came into the group, and a friend, Langston George, was also a member of the Pips for a while. But what became Gladys Knight and the Pips was Gladys, her brother Bubba, my brother-in-law William, Edward, and Edward Patton.
Got
three
it.
Pips and Gladys, yeah.
Now, I think William was the best dancer of the group, wasn't he?
Well, I'm glad you said that. Because
he was. I mean, you could tell.
That is absolutely true. And, you know, they were trained with by Charlie Atkins, of Charlie Atkins and Honey Coles, Atkins Coles group from back there in the 40s.
Uh-huh.
Charlie Atkins really polished their act, and he always said that William was the best dancer because he got the steps exactly right.
Yeah. He had a feeling. It was the music that drove him. It was like it was inside of him when he danced. You know what I mean?
Yes. And, you know, and he would be the first to say that he was probably singing and dancing in the womb. So, as a little boy, he grew up with his grandmother and mother and uncle, and they would have jam sessions on the back porch where all the neighbors would come and hear them sing and play music. So that was his life. He grew up in it.
Wow. You know, that group was iconic, a classical group. When did Gladys Knight separate from the group? Was it 1962?
That was 1989.
Oh, 89. Oh, okay.
Yeah, 1989 the group broke up. I mean, they were together 37 years, almost four decades.
Really?
Because they started as kids, you know, in high school in 1952. The other thing is Merrill Knight Sr., Bubba's father, and William's mother, they all sang in a adult gospel choir, and the kids were singing in a youth gospel choir.
Oh, for heaven's sake. So it was a family affair, right?
It was a family affair all the way across the board.
Amazing. So when they first started, I mean, were they part of the Apollo and Soul Train?
They were all a part of that. Later, when they came up to, you know, New York by the late 50s, when they got with Bobby Robinson, that's again how the group became Gladys Knight and the Pips, because they were the Pips and they had already recorded their first song, Every Beat of My Heart, but they didn't know that the person who recorded that song was going to put it out. Oh. They thought they were just invited over to do a recording, and they thought that would be great. They had no idea that this person, Clifford Hunter, was actually going to put out the record and put out the record in the South. And it became an issue because, in fact, my brother-in-law was walking down the street by a record shop and then all of a sudden heard the song in the record shop.
No kidding.
And he calls Bubba and says, you know, I just heard it. And Bubba says, I know, I just heard it. They did not know. So actually, that was put out. They didn't get any royalties from it, but a DJ really got a hold of the record. Then it got to Bobby Robinson, Fury Records in New York. Bobby Robinson re-recorded the record on them. Mm-hmm. And to distinguish between the two recordings, they decided that if one would be called Gladys Knight and the Pips. That's how Gladys got out in front, because they were all lead singers.
Wow.
So they all could lead. So that's how that happened. And that's when they came to New York and first started playing the Apollo Theater, which is sort of how my family got into the play, because my father actually was the lead singer of the Mourning Dove Gospel Quartet.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yes, and my sister and I, we were, and my late brother, who could also sing, we were dancers. As little kids, you know, in the community center. In fact, we studied dance at Menasink, where Debbie Allen studied dance. So,
no kidding.
Growing up in New York City in Harlem during those days, there were the community centers that developed the arts and the extracurriculum activities for kids, and that's how we started dancing. And so my mother, they used to love amateur night at the Apollo, which was every Wednesday night. So we would go to the Apollo with my family, and I remember we had the same little box seats in the front, and my sister and I, as a matter of fact, won the dance contest at the Apollo. We won the twist.
Wow.
And it just so happens that, I was like 11 years old, and my sister was 15, because by that time they had met the group, because my mother knew Bobby Robinson. But anyway, we had them rooting for us backstage, and we had people in the audience. So I won for the little kids, and she won for the big kids. So we won the twist contest. So we were going to the Apollo most of my life, just every Wednesday. You know, again, my family loved music. We would play music in the house. But then after, you know, my sister met my brother-in-law, and then our families became one family, you know, because they were all still young, because they started playing after singing gospel in the church when they were in high school. They started playing gigs around Atlanta, and also then getting on the road. They started with just gospel, and then they started going around with, you know, like groups like B.B. King and all of them. Later on, they were actually performing with B.B. a lot, too.
It's sort of like it's families. Their destinies were intertwined and it all began at the Mount Moriah Baptist Church, yes?
Mount Moriah Baptist Church. That's where they were. I'm from New York, so we met them after they got to New York.
Got it.
But their whole career actually started in that Mount Moriah Baptist Church, as many gospel singers, you know, Patti LaBelle, Whitney Houston, Franklin, et cetera. So they started out as gospel, and then they started singing pop. And let me just go back a little bit about how the group first started,
please.
And they discovered they could sing. It was Bubba's birthday party. And they didn't have a record player. That was, you know, we're going back in the days where, you know, we're streaming music now. So young people listening to this, they would say, what are you talking about? But they had a physical little record player that they had Garfield, a little friend of theirs, come over to the birthday party. And he had the music. And they were spending the 45 records.
I remember those.
You know what the 45s are.
Yeah.
And then Garfield had to, they started singing together and enjoying music, but he had to go home and he took the record player. So then they just decided to start singing themselves. And then the parents said, wow, these kids sound so good together. And they decided to form a group. That's how it happened.
Wow.
Just with a radio player that left, and their voices became front and center.
It was meant to be, that's the whole thing.
Yes, it was just meant to be in divine order.
How was William's grandmother? She had lessons to guide them, didn't she?
Oh, Mama Tilly. Remember those back, well, I was talking about the back porch jams?
Mm-hmm.
Mama Tilly played the guitar.
Oh.
And yes, and her brother also played music. So Mama Tilly actually taught him harmony, how to sing harmony in the kitchen while she was cooking.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
She would give him certain notes and they would sing harmony together. So he credits her for teaching him harmony. But, you know, again, if you think about their harmonic voices, their harmony,
extraordinary.
I was thinking about it for this interview, about what made them so special. Their harmony was so solid and unique, and just sort of a harmonic class act. They were instruments as well as voices, what they could do, and blending those sounds together with just, it was just amazing.
I
love the music.
Of course. It's classic. It's going to go on forever.
It will.
So tell me a little bit more about William. I know, and this is in your book, that he had 11 children, but with five women, but always loved your sister, Pat.
Yes, until the day he died, I remember. We were all there, and the night before, because my niece and I were the last ones with him, you know, when he was still conscious. Bubba flew in that night, but I'll get to that story, go back. But mm-hmm. William, he was such a personality. He was a big personality, lots of laughter, just fun. Everybody loved him because he was so humorous. In fact, that whole group, we would be, you know, as a little kid, I was backstage with them in the Waldorf Hotel and various things on the road. There were jokes going around all the time, and he was just sort of the leader of the pack. But his talent, I mean, for example, in the third grade, his teacher just gave him a trumpet. He started playing it.
Oh, my. Well, that's a prodigy.
And Sister Eleanor started playing the clarinet. He just figured out the notes. So the great talent, the musical talent, and, you know, one of the things, just with entertainers in general, because people have asked me over the years about, while we had all these outside children, et cetera, I watched him and my sister throughout, you know, his life, throughout her life. And I, you know, even interviewed her for the book because they used to say, well, how do you like him? I mean, he was a brother. They got married 3 weeks before I lost my brother.
Aww.
So he stepped in and he became the brother and the son.
Okay.
We became one family, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
And not saying that those indiscretions were overlooked, because that was between he and my sister, which my sister eventually divorced him. But they had a friendship and a relationship that was bigger and broader and so far out of my understanding.
There you go.
Did she
continue to love him all the time, do you think?
That Pat what?
That Pat continued to love William?
Yes. Now, we argue about this because if you would see them, I mean, even years, even the last year of his life, they were out, you would still think they were married. They were still arm in arm, and they enjoyed each other. You know, they laughed and had a lot of fun, and they shared a house until he died.
Oh, no kidding.
You know, but she will tell me, and if she hears this interview, she'll say, sis, I told you, he was more like a brother to me. I learned to love him like a brother. You know, but the love and our family love was much deeper, much wider than anyone could see. And back, you know, you deal with, and he even will talk about his indiscretions that, you know, the women hit on him all the time. He was a good-looking man.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
even as a young man in school, he had teachers hitting on him.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
You know, so, and then you're a big entertainer. You're kind of, you know, full of yourself. This still happens.
Yeah.
And entertainment, and it's not good. Not saying that it's good.
But it is what it is. Yeah.
It is what it is. And he got caught up.
Now,
you know,
didn't he almost die?
He loved being a pit, and, you know, women surrounded them all the time.
I bet.
See, Gladys was married to the saxophone player first.
Oh.
So she was married in the group, but they were single. So they tell the jokes. They had women who cleaned the apartment for them.
Oh, my gosh.
In New York, who cooked for them, bought them gifts. And he would, like he said in the book, I wasn't a pimp or anything, but I did not turn down the gifts that they were giving
him. Yeah.
So, you know, you have these great entertainers and the women out there, and, you know, again, I would not be a woman to just run after, you know, a man just because they're a singer, but there were many who did that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And she, I would say, for she knew what it was and what she was in. She never had to want for anything. He always took care of her and the household and the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And what they dealt with as far as their own personal lives and their relationships together, because he was my brother, you know, from 11 years old.
Yeah.
He was my brother. So I did not get into that with him. She finally divorced him And he still stayed upstairs, you know, even until the day, I said, like the day before he passed, he would always still call up. You know, you're my little wife.
Aww.
You're still my wife.
Now, didn't William almost die in a car accident?
Yes, when they were, he actually went in the cardiac arrest. The car that, it was snow and ice. And they were in two different cars, and one of the cars, I think Gladys and Bubba were in that car, T-Bone, the car he was in.
Ooh.
He was asleep in the back seat, so he was caught with his arms folded, and his legs were smashed.
Oh, dear.
Langston, that fourth pip that I said was in the group for a little while, he gave him artificial respiration and kept him alive.
Oh, wow.
He was in the hospital for a while, but he was determined he was going to get up. And within a few months, he was up and back on the road with them.
That's amazing.
Blessed.
This is also an interesting story. The Hall of Fame band was actually formed by William, and he helped them to rise to the top?
The Hall of Fame?
Yeah, the Hall of Fame band. Was there a Hall of Fame?
I don't know.
Okay. I had read up that something about the
Hall of Fame. Yeah, they were in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but that was in 1996. They were inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Okay.
Later on in his life, he managed a couple of other groups. The Stub Girls, the Levi Stubbs of the Four Tops,
mm-hmm.
his daughters and grandchildren, that was a group that he was trying to record and was getting gigs for them before he passed.
Got it. So what was it like to be a part of Motown Records? What was it like?
I mean, Motown was just, in fact, that's how they got to Detroit. I remember in 1966 when they moved to Motown. You know, Motown was the sound and just the rhythm, the mecca. And it's so funny because Gladys did not necessarily want to go to Motown.
Oh.
She actually thought that she would get, you know, lost because you had Diana Ross, you know, you had the Marvelettes,
mm-hmm.
you had so many girl groups and stuff that they were cultivating at that time. But see, what Motown was good for, and as I mentioned, Charlie Atkins, the dancer, when Gladys and the group had a chance to go to Motown, they would not go without Charlie Atkins. Motown wanted Charlie Atkins to help cultivate their groups and steps as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they became a package.
Oh.
They signed with Motown. Charlie Atkins came, but it was with the understanding that he would work with Gladys Knight and the Pips. Motown, they had a whole methodology where they cultivated their groups. They prepared them for class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the women had to take etiquette.
No kidding.
You know, besides the dancing and the singing and all of that, they had to just learn ethics and good behavior and stuff like that. Not that everybody in Motown practiced.
Followed it, yeah.
You know, but as far as cultivating the talent, they were good on that. And not only that, outside of their recordings, and, you know, they would have the Motown Review, so the acts would be on the road together.
Mm-hmm.
They would also have various functions. I remember one thing in that my sister loved them too, and Catherine of the Marvelettes, who wrote the preface for the book, who was one of the members of the Marvelettes, she who passed just before the book actually came out.
Aww.
But they, and she even talked about it, the Motown picnics. They would, you know, they cultivated a family among Motown.
Yeah.
So they would have picnics where all of the groups and their families could come out and just have fun for a day and have various activities. But that Motown sound of the 1960s and 70s, I mean, it is still, the rhythm of the day.
Yep.
It is still the music of the day because it was so powerful.
And unique.
That particular sound.
And unique. It was unique.
Yeah.
And now, they had so many documentaries and reports over the years that Motown, they were taken advantage of, yada, yada. They didn't get the residuals that they should. Was that true?
That was true. That's also in the book. That's one of the reasons why they ended up leaving Motown. Barry Gordy actually was trying to sue them because they were leaving. But, I mean, not only they ended up, I mean, back then in those days, the 50s and the 60s, there was a big problem with royalties. I mean, all of the money they made with Bobby Robinson and stuff before they went to Motown, they didn't get any of those royalties. They would tell them something like, well, you see all those suits and outfits that you have on and... where you're staying in these hotels and, these cars and stuff, but they never got, and they never got to really see the true books. So Motown did not win with them because they ended up going to Buddha Records. But after a while, all that legal stuff got caught up in them being on Buddha. And then Gladys wanting to do some other things. In fact, they were at three different record companies at one time.
Wow.
Gladys was on Columbia, Gladys Knight and the Pips was on Buddha, and the Pips were on Casablanca by themselves.
I'll be darned.
So that was sort of the beginning when things started, spiraling, where they wanted to do different things. Because, they started getting involved with films.
Yeah.
And... depending on what the situation was, sometimes they would try to go directly to Gladys. Sometimes the whole group would be involved. So it sort of became a slippery slope in the late 80s when they broke up. But, of course, their Buddha days, Midnight Train from Georgia, which you started, Midnight Train to Georgia. I'm so used to the title of the
book. That's okay.
That was their Grammy-winning song when they went to Buddha Records that really catapulted them to a new height, where they really started really going all over the world and, singing for major events, singing... Claudine, the Diane Carroll movie, they did the soundtrack for that. So things were, sort of growing. And Claudine, which was actually produced by Barry Hagenson, that Gladys married, who was actually one grade above me at Resurrection School, where they actually got married. so this stuff just kind of, came around. But... He was again a big personality, and as you said in your intro, this group was built on love, family, and faith. They prayed before every performance.
Aww.
They split their money four different ways, So they kept that bond. Sometimes when husbands and I don't know too much about the wives. I've never seen, too many things with the wives of, the Pips. In fact, Bubba married Kathy twice. He's still with Kathy.
Is he the only Pip that's still alive?
He's the only Pip that's still alive. Edward passed in 2005. He was like my father. I followed the two of them, but they, from 11 years old, they would take me all around. And, I spent part of my early career in music, too. I had a number one song I wrote, Time Moves On by Strut, a disco song. So
oh, for
it's so
say.
Funny. People, Yeah, people, when I went and became a professor and all of this other stuff, they knew me for music and entertainment.
Do you ever still keep touch with Gladys? I know she's still alive. She's still touring, isn't she? Or some?
Yeah, well, she's she does a couple of things. In 2023, she was a Kennedy Award.
Yes.
It's been our honoree. And they had people playing the pips.
Mm-hmm.
because she still sings Gladys Knight and the Pips records. They can't dance and sing like the Pips.
No.
But, but she does not perform very much.
Oh. Do you get a chance to talk to her or see her very much? No?
I have not seen her myself since actually the funeral. My sister and, the kids, my nieces and stuff, we're all connected on Facebook, the Knight children, the Guest children, the Pattons, all of them. So we kind of all know what's going on. So we'll hear it about her from other
sources.
People. My sister
My
sister probably talks to Bubba more, still, but even when I go out to, Vegas to the broadcasting conference, in fact, Bubba used to run around with me sometimes. So he's still out there.
Now, I got to ask you, I'd be remiss if I didn't find out, how did you get knighted?
Well, first of all, you really never know why they select you. And I went to our webpage, which is SOKJ.com, Sovereign Order of the Knights of Justice. But this is what I think, I used to do a lot of world forums and perform and do presentations at Oxford and Cambridge and stuff in the UK. One year in 2007, I was on a panel. Sir Gary was also doing a presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was in 2007. So later on that year, I got an invitation to a knighting ceremony at Warwick Castle in Warwick, England. So I remember going to my provost, who says, I'm not going to pay for this. And I said, that's okay. I'll pay for it. Because I was just curious. I had no idea what all this was about. So I went to Warwick, and it was a big knighting ceremony that particular night. And they strategically placed me at a table with Sir Roger. I didn't even know what all of that was about and that they were sort of looking at me. They gave me a medal that year. I remember they gave a medical doctor from Ethiopia, and they gave me a medal. They knighted four people, but they gave us a medallion. Him for his medical work, my work in education. I was doing a lot. I was out front in technology. My dissertation was the second on technology and education. So I also was doing work for the State Department and USAID and all of that. I evaluate tenure and promotion of foreign service diplomats. So I'm doing some work, and all of a sudden I get this call from the Grand Chancellor, and he says, Lady Diana. And that's how I knew I was going to be knighted.
I
was just shocked. He called me that, and I had to, do some paperwork and stuff. But on April 2008, I was knighted.
You were knighted.
In Cambridge.
Now, we run out of time, but I want to make sure. Do you have a website?
For the book?
Yes,
Midnight Train from Georgia.info.
.info, okay. And the book, I assume, Midnight Train from Georgia is available every place, yes?
Yes. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere out there. It's
fantastic.
Out there. Well, and it's a good story. It's won a couple of awards. It's won the Book Fest Award, third prize for memoir, and it just won the International Impact Book Award in December.
Well, let's keep touch, okay?
Yes.
I love it.
I love talking to you.
Oh, thank you. You're a sweetheart. And stay well. We'll talk again, okay?
All right. Thank you so much, and you have a blessed day.
And you too. In the meantime, live simply, laugh often, love deeply, and above all else,